Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the last day of April, April 30th. It's All Things Political on Mondays at 9 o'clock, and we have two great guests with us this hour. E.J. Dionne is joining us, Washington Post columnist, and later this hour, Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Much to discuss with both gentlemen. We're going to start with E.J. with a column that he wrote, Gun Law Pragmatism, a column that you can get online Friday, April 20th. He asks in the column, why it is that we have the same futile argument every time there's a mass killing. Democrats have become wimps on the gun issue. Most Republicans are opportunists on the gun issue. And he says, when Richard Reid showed that nasty things could be done with shoes on airplanes, airport security started examining shoes. When liquids were seen as a potential danger, we regulated the quantity of liquids we could take on flights. We barred people from carrying concealed weapons on airlines long ago. If we can act pragmatically in the skies, why can't we be equally practical here on the ground? We're going to start with that issue and move into other issues with E.J., Washington Post columnist who joined the Post in 1990 as a reporter covering national politics, began his op-ed column in 93, and is syndicated now to more than 100 other newspapers. He's the author of a number of books, is a regular political analyst on National Public Radio. He teaches at the Georgetown Public Policy Institute as a university professor in the Foundation of Democracy and Culture, spent 14 years with the New York Times, and also he's with the Brookings Institution as a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee. It is 414-227-2050. Hello, E.J., happy Monday, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you. And incidentally, I'm working at home this morning, so if you hear a dog bark, she's a very friendly dog.
I remember you got a dog.
Yes, we did.
We talked about that.
A rescue dog. Our kids very much wanted one.
Aww.
And so we think it's part chow and part lab. So she's very pretty.
What a mixture. There's nothing. I love dogs. I'm a real dog woman, so it's okay if your dog barks.
It's fine.
Let's start with this gun issue, because at least you came out and said something. Not many people have. Why have Democrats, as you say, become wimps on the gun issue, and most Republicans are opportunists on the gun issue?
Democrats became wimps out of bitter experience, it must be said, that a lot of people thought Al Gore lost in 2000. Well, some of us don't think he actually lost, but didn't make it to the White House in 2000 because the gun issue hurt him in parts of New Hampshire and West Virginia. Also because Democrats have started to gain substantial ground in rural areas and also in the Rocky Mountain West, right through the Rocky Mountain West. And so there is a reluctance to heat up the gun issue in any way. And I understand that as pragmatic politics, but it really bothers me that after an event of this sort, we can't even discuss very modest mm-hmm. measures to regulate guns. There's no country in the world, no industrial country in the world that has the kind of laws we have on guns. And as a result, there's no industrial country in the world that has the level of gun violence that we have in the United States, industrial or post-industrial, whatever you want, a big, large, affluent democracies. And, you know, I don't think anybody who supports sort of sane gun regulation wants to interfere with rural culture. We don't want to get in the way of people who own guns, particularly for hunting. But especially in our rural and suburban areas, unregulated firearms are a real danger, and I think you are at least seeing some modest movement a couple of weeks after this horrible event in Virginia Tech, where people are realizing that the instant check that should have kept a gun out of this gentleman's hands didn't work. And mm-hmm. so we might at least have some of even the gun lobby being supportive of toughening up those checks. That would be at least a small bit of progress. But you also have a lot of mayors around the country
yes.
who have started, including Tom Barrett up
right.
there in Milwaukee, who's allied with Mayor Bloomberg of New York, Mayor Menino of Boston, to say, look, we're the guys and women who have to comfort people in our neighborhoods mm-hmm. when there are gunshots. Why are we making it so hard for local authorities, local police, to get the information they need to prosecute gun crimes, to trace guns? So you are making some progress, but I was disappointed that so many Democrats were making, I think, primarily a political calculation on this, and were just kind of running away from the issue. And I think that's why I wrote so strongly, because I thought, you know, I'm a columnist. I don't have to face an electorate.
Right.
And if I'm not willing to say something, then how can I ask anybody else to?
Well, I'm glad you brought attention to it. You know, and I think a Republican or a Democrat, if they called on their stages during their many debates for what you call for, a national bipartisan commission that would propose ways to look at gun laws and to look at our culture of violence, I think this is a bipartisan issue, that this would be a good campaign issue. It would be something that people in this country are concerned about.
No, I agree with that, obviously. And I think that, you know, part of the problem on the gun issue is that the people who vote on the issue are folks who are opposed to any kind or almost any kind of regulation of guns. And that's their constitutional right. They can do that. The problem on the other side is, even though a very substantial majority of Americans support things such as the assault weapons ban, which has been allowed to expire, they are not. It's not a voting issue for that side. And so I do think there's a lot of work that needs to be done among people who are for reasonable gun regulation to figure out how to turn it into an electoral issue that actually works for the people who support rational gun regulation. As long as the only people voting on it are the people on the other side, that side will win even when it's a minority of the electorate. I saw somewhere where President Clinton was quoted as saying that the people who want to regulate guns don't give enough political cover to people who fight for sane gun regulation. I think there's some truth to that.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of this question, and what did you make of the answers of who has a gun in the House? Edwards, Clinton, Obama, the only ones on that forum to say no.
Well, the majority of Americans don't have guns in their homes. And oddly, at a time when our friends on the pro-gun side have such political influence, the percentage of people with guns in their household is dropping. And there are good reasons for that. A lot of what happens with guns is not intentional. It's accidental. People who are suicidal would be more inclined to do terrible harm to themselves or kill themselves when a gun is available. So people are walking away from having guns. The one thing that I think is absurd, and I don't think persuades a single person in the community of people who own guns, is for people who've lived in cities and suburbs all their life to pretend that they are part of that rural culture. I just think it rings very phony. It doesn't mean you don't respect that culture. I mean, my godfather, God bless him, late godfather, was a hunter. I understand people who are in that culture and have, you know, no hostility to them at all. But I think when politicians pretend to be something they're not, and that happens a lot on the gun issue, it's just not very seemly, and I don't think it persuades a soul.
Yeah. Let's talk about George Tenet for a moment. He's all over the press this morning and over the weekend with his discussions about the fact that the Bush administration didn't have any real discussion about Iraq. I always wonder, EJ, why doesn't somebody like that, why didn't he leave? Why don't those people create some kind of a stir while they're in a position of power and say there's something off base here instead of doing it so much later?
I think I've asked the same question. I think a lot of people are asking that question. On the one hand, I think that what Tenet has done is useful because he has provided an account of what happened internally that only he could provide. And the notion that Iraq was on their radar screen even before the events of 9/11, there was a lot of evidence for that before. I think it's important that someone like George Tenet has confirmed that. So I don't personally fault him for writing this book. I think, you know, there's a lot of useful information in that book that might help us avoid some of these problems. But I think you have two problems. One is, you know, original sin or human nature. People tend to go along with the administration they're part of. They tend to sort of value the power they have. And I think Tenet, in that sense, is a normal, flawed human being, but we all are to some degree. And I also think there was a terrible groupthink at that time. It took a lot of courage for people at that moment to stand up, even outside the administration, to say, you know, this is really not a good idea. And, you know, and Tenet, but I think there were a number of people I know who were in the administration in that period who did harbor grave doubts about this. And I happen to know that a number of them really feel that they should have spoken up more, and I sure wish George Tenet if he had those kind of doubts then, had spoken up. Mm-hmm. I think his problem politically, as this book comes out and the debate goes on, is he's probably going to be attacked from both the left and the right. The left will go after him asking precisely that question, why didn't you do something? And, of course, the right will attack him for being disloyal to President Bush, although he's very he pulls his punches on Bush. He really goes after Vice President Cheney, Doug Feith, and a lot of Condoleezza Rice, almost everyone else except President Bush.
Yeah. Briefly, before we go to phone calls, this stalemate between Congress and the president on the war, the president strongly rejecting an artificial timetable withdrawal, where does this go now?
Yeah, I love that term, by the way, artificial timetable, because it implies that there is a natural timetable for withdrawal from Iraq, and I'd like to know what is that natural timetable. I think, you know, this all timetables are imposed by political forces, either by the president or by the Congress. I think the there is one potential consensus position in Congress, and I'm not even sure that they can get there, which would be to have benchmarks. The Iraqi government has to do certain things, and the Congress has been very careful to quote only the president setting these. All of the president's sort of standards for the Iraqi government they have written into the bill. And possibly with some, you know, some trigger where if these weren't met, there would either be the beginning of a withdrawal or the president would have to come back and report why there shouldn't be. The problem with that is a lot of anti-war folks in the Congress, including your own Senator Feingold, are reluctant to even give that much ground to the president. On the other side, Condoleezza Rice this weekend made very clear that they don't want any benchmarks or limits on presidential authority. I think at a certain point the administration is much better off, and I don't expect them to listen to me, but I think they're much better off to try to deal with Congress, because I think President Bush's confrontational attitude toward Congress hasn't done him any good at all. And the core question underlying this, I think, is, are we going to make an unlimited commitment to stay there for an indefinite period of time, which is really what I think underlies the president's position, or are we going to say the military force has reached its limits as to what it can do to resolve this situation, and that we will begin to withdraw troops, and whether it's in a year or a year and a half or 2 years, the vast majority of the American people do not think this war is doing us any good and maybe doing us some harm. I think we'll end up there eventually. I think the people who are really going to decide this in the end are Republicans. Republicans who harbor private doubts about the war now. And the question will be, how many of them come out and say, Mr. President, this just isn't working anymore? Susan Collins of Maine, who faces re-election, the senator from Maine, has indicated she is will probably move in that direction. It'll be very interesting to see how many more do between now and September.
E.J. Dionne is our guest, Washington Post columnist, All Things Political, Monday mornings at 9, where we talk with fine political minds about all that's going on in Washington. And we welcome your phone calls. There are lines open for E.J. right now. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. John Treader is answering phone calls. He'll chat with you for a moment, and we'll get you on the air just as soon as we can. Craig Gilbert, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, will be joining us the second part of this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we talk about the wage gap. Dr. Heidi Hartman will join us, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. They came out with a major study on this last week. All right, let's go to phone calls for EJ, 800-486-8655. Sally from Middleton, hello. Hello, Sally, are you there? What in the world is wrong here?
Did we lose Sally?
Yeah, I don't know if there's something wrong with my board here or if there's a problem with Sally. Sally, are you there? Well, I don't know where she is. Let's try Scott from Watertown. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
There, all right. I guess we lost Sally, but we got Scott. Hi, Scott.
Morning. That's the fastest I've ever gotten on. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
I guess I have two questions. First, I'd like his comments on the following observation. You know, by appointing General Petraeus and now starting the COIN Institute, which I heard about on this morning's news show, it seems that even if he hasn't stated it, that there's a recognition that the entire thrust of the mission up till now has been wrong. We've been fighting the wrong war. We've been fighting a traditional war rather than a counterinsurgency war. And yet, and he would gain, I think, amongst most Americans who oppose the war, tremendous traction if he'd actually say that. And I don't know whether he's too proud or too stupid to figure it out that that's actually what's gone on, or whether he just thinks that he can't, you know, he can't risk dumping his base or something. I don't know. So that's one comment. And then the other thing is on George Tenet's book, which, of course, I've not read yet since it was just released, does he... Several other things I've read imply that from even before George Bush came into office, he was fixated on Iraq. And my own personal theory is that he's trying to clean up his father's legacy because loyalty is one of his great personality traits and the thing he values the most. Is that something that's in the book, or because it seems a pretty messed up reason to have been fixated on Iraq from actually the first National Security Council meeting that he had.
All right, Scott, or Scott E.G.
Those are great questions. On the second, if I could do that first,
sure.
I have not read Tenet's book yet. I'm hoping to do it this week, so I am relying on the press accounts and Tenet's own telling of the story. I do think the caller is right that this idea was clearly floating around not only in President Bush's mind, but in certain, you know, in policy circles who always wanted to, quote, finish the first war and opposed President Bush's decision to stop the war after we freed Kuwait from Saddam's control. I must say, I have always been one of the only people who defended the first President Bush for stopping the war, because I thought he was right then in seeing that if we invaded Iraq, we would have all kinds of problems. There's wonderful footage of Vice President Cheney, then Secretary of Defense, explaining why invading Iraq was such a dangerous idea. I do think we had the one thing where I fault the first administration is I think we had a moral obligation to the Shiites in the South after encouraging them to rise up. We really did nothing for them. We helped the Kurds in the North, which was right, by imposing the no-fly zone. We shouldn't have encouraged rebellion in the South and then done nothing for them. But the idea of non-invading was a good idea. I do think it's quite possible that it does have some connection with finishing the job of started by the first President Bush, although I think the irony is that if the first President Bush had been in the White House in 2001, 2002, I am not at all convinced he would have started this war. Brent Scowcroft, the foreign policy advisor to the first President Bush, someone he is very close to, was very much against this war. So I am still not whether it's finishing the job of the first president or doing better than his dad did, or maybe, of course, this whole psychological explanation is wrong, that it was really a philosophical and ideological thing. Whatever is the case, I continue to believe that invading Iraq had nothing to do with responding to 9/11, mm-hmm. whereas the invasion of Afghanistan did have something to do with responding to Afghanistan. And the first question, if the caller could repeat it, it was also a good question. Are you there?
Scott, are you there? All right. In the interest of time, we'll just deal with that question, if that's okay with you.
Because I think I basically agreed with the thrust of his first question, but as I said, I had not read Tenet's book.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Joy from West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Well, here we are again talking about the war in Iraq, and I have noticed, I don't know how many other people have noticed, that not only the Republicans, but also the Democrats don't even talk about what I would see as the real reason why we went into Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter. You know, we could have gone after bin Laden as a criminal, not as the whole country of Afghanistan. We want to be there to protect our oil interests. We want to be in the whole neighborhood of the Middle East to protect our oil interests, and that's why they don't want to have a timeline to get out, because we want to really stay there. And so I'm just wondering, if George Tenet or if anybody, if anybody's going to blow the whistle on the real reason.
All right, EJ.
By the way, I remembered the first half of the question, the first question, which I just want to deal with briefly because I think he's right, that this new strategy suggests that the administration realized that its old strategy was all wrong. I think that's true. My friends who defend the war, I still have friends I disagree with, do a much better job defending this surge when they admit that. I think the president would do well to acknowledge that, but I think it's too late in some sense to persuade those of us who thought he was wrong in the first place, but I think he'd be better off to acknowledge it. On the oil business, I think two things are true at the same time, which is, would we have all this engagement in that region if they had absolutely no oil? The answer is almost certainly no. Oil gives that region, and Iraq in particular, strategic importance. Do I believe both these wars are primarily about oil? No, I don't. I think in the case of Iraq, there were a lot of things going on. Oil was one, but this whole dream that if you could only turn Iraq into a model democracy, you would transform the Middle East. I really believe a lot of people who supported and were architects of this war believe that. I think it was a bad miscalculation, but they believe that. In terms of Afghanistan, I've always thought that invasion was justified because you weren't simply talking about a police action against bin Laden. You had a government in power in Afghanistan which was giving material support to the people who had attacked us on 9/11 and were allowing them a kind of safe haven there. I think that is a legitimate reason. There are people who are pacifists. I admire them. Personally, I'm not a pacifist, and so I thought this was a plausible response, measured in a way, certainly measured compared to going into to Iraq. So that's my take on the oil question.
Yeah. Thanks, EJ. Your dog was very good, wasn't
it? Yes, no, the dog was great. And it's always great to be with you.
Thanks,
thank
EJ. You. Thanks so much for being with us. EJ Dionne, Washington Post columnist, joined the Post in 1990 as a reporter. He covered national politics. His op-ed column started in 1993 and is syndicated to more than 100 other newspapers. If you go to WashingtonPost.com and type in EJ, you can get a lot of his columns, and he covers many, many issues. So we thank him. It's All Things Political this Monday morning. Craig Gilbert will be joining us momentarily, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a fairly regular guest with us on Mondays to talk about what's been going on in Washington. We also want to tell you that our spring pledge drive is going to be starting May 3rd, but if you want to pledge online before the drive, it would shorten this drive, and that would be terrific. Members have contributed over $11,000 toward our goal of $275,000, and when we reach that goal, the drive will end. If we reach it before May 3rd, then we wouldn't even have a drive. So all you have to do is pledge online. And it's WPR.org, WPR.org for you to pledge online. We have all phone lines open for whatever you'd like to talk about, be it the war in Iraq, be it the debates that you saw last week, Thursday, the Democrats. This week it will be the Republicans. Craig wrote an interesting column about John McCain, or a story that was in the Journal Sentinel yesterday. We can talk about the Democrats and the Republican response to guns. We can talk about George Tenet. You name it. It's up to you, too, where you want the conversation to go. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 for those of you who are in the Milwaukee area. Hello, Craig. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Interesting story on McCain yesterday and campaign finance reform. For those people who didn't see it, who's upset with McCain on this issue?
Well, on the Republican side, you name it. I mean, two examples, two big important groups on the right, the National Right to Life Committee and the NRA, the National Rifle Association, have both been kind of veterans of the campaign finance wars in the courts and have fought this law vigorously and continuously. And the fight goes on. We just had the case last Wednesday with Wisconsin Right to Life challenge to the way the law was applied to ads they ran in 2004 in Wisconsin. So it's a very live issue, and there's just I don't think people realize how much kind of visceral and loathing there is of this ad among among activists on the right who really dislike it for a whole variety of reasons.
What does it do to McCain's campaign? When you look at this, it's been considered a crowning bipartisan achievement on the part of Democrats and Republicans. If the Supreme Court rules to do away with, you know, to narrow this to allow more of what they were trying to get rid of, what does it do for McCain?
Well, you know, the irony is this area of the law that's being contested was not as much at the core of what McCain and Feingold set out to do in their campaign finance law as the so-called soft money ban, which is not under challenge, and which was the effort to prevent the parties and members of Congress from raising, you know, unlimited $500,000, seven-figure contributions. That part of the law is very much intact. This part of the law has to do with ads that are aired by independent groups around the time of the election, and whether the way they're financed should be restricted or not under certain circumstances. And, you know, people were surprised, actually, a lot of people were surprised when that part of the law passed muster with the court back in 2003. It was a very close call, and people thought that if any part of the law was going to be thrown out, that would be it. And it wasn't. It survived 5-4, but certainly there's an expectation that it could be narrowed. Its application could be narrowed, but we just don't know how much. I think I think campaign finance, the campaign finance law, is a credential for McCain when it comes to independent voters, certainly. But I also think for people who are certainly for the, as one person in the story called it, the activist right, it's a liability for him.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear how much of a burning issue it is for rank-and-file Republican voters, but I don't think it's something that would cause them necessarily to vote against McCain in most cases, but I think it's not something that they see as a positive.
Yeah. The Republicans have their debate this week. Democrats, let's start with the Democrats. They had theirs last week. Any wonderful observations on last week's debate that we haven't already heard, Craig?
You know, the thing about these debates is I think they're really, for the so-called frontier candidates, they're kind of a chore. I think they think more about and worry more about, you know, doing something stupid and hurting themselves. Whereas I think for the so-called second tier candidates who don't get as much media attention, they're an opportunity. And they're an opportunity to kind of set yourself, they're an opportunity both to set yourself apart from the other so-called second tier candidates and to try to, you know, kind of break into this upper tier where you get more media attention. And I'm not sure anybody did that dramatically in the first debate. It'll be really interesting to see in this Republican debate coming up, I believe, on Thursday in California. If anybody does that in that debate, the Republican field is so much more kind of unsettled than the Democratic field, even though both races are really open-ended. There's a lot more kind of instability in the Republican field because the best-known candidates in the Republican field all have kind of clear issues and liabilities with parts of the Republican Party, and they're not necessarily as widely acceptable to party voters as the Democrats are to their voters. So there's more opportunity for someone to either come in late in the race or to emerge from this second rank, and the debate is one place they might be able to
right.
do that.
It's going to be a hard thing to manage, isn't it? 10 people, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's difficult for everybody. It's difficult for the viewers. It's difficult as a journalist, incredibly difficult. I mean, debates are hard enough to write about because you can't do justice to a debate in a story. I mean, people really have to watch a debate. To get something out of a debate, you have to watch it because aside from the fact that so much more ground is covered, but you just, it's important to get a sense of a real sense of the candidates, and that's what debates are for. But when you have 10 candidates or 9 candidates or 8 candidates, it just takes on a kind of a different dynamic, and everybody has to kind of work harder to call attention to themselves. That gives the debate kind of an artificial feeling. They can't spend very much time on one subject. They certainly can't have anything like a conversation.
Yeah. I guess I just learned last week that they plan to have 11 or 12 of these before the primaries. Why did everybody agree to so many debates?
Well, this has been a big source of discussion internally, particularly on the Democratic side, where they've come to some sort of understanding about, I believe, about not having more than one a month. Certainly that's not something that particularly the better known candidates want to do, is have these constant debates. For one thing, it takes them off the campaign trail, and it takes them away from fundraising and the other things they have to do in the campaign. It's expensive when you start talking about, you know, putting your campaign on hold and bringing a whole lot of people to the side of the debate.
Mm-hmm.
There's been efforts to kind of control it, but then you have all this pressure from groups and states to have their moment.
We're going to welcome phone calls now for Craig Gilbert. He is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we go to Dave from Menominee for our first caller for you. Hi, Dave.
Hi. The story that just really I was just upset about when I saw this week was the Pat Tillman and Jessica Lynch propaganda fiasco that we've been handed. And I was just extremely offended when I found out that after he was killed, his fellow soldiers went and grabbed all his stuff, you know, grabbed his diary and his uniform, and they burned it all. And then we find something that I already knew, that Pat Tillman was an atheist, and which doesn't offend me at all. Everybody has their own right to believe what they want. But what really caught my attention was he didn't participate in like group prayers, and he was like a singled out black sheep type guy there, and was just really interested in how much of a factor that had into this big mistake that happened.
What do you mean? What are you getting at?
Well, you know, the circumstances that surround this thing, how his platoon was split into two, and he was left literally almost by himself, only one other soldier by him,
mm-hmm.
and he was caught in a huge crossfire, and then, of course, we were told a whole bunch of different things. We got four generals that are under investigation, and the House Oversight Committee is requesting all paperwork generated or received having to do with this. And, I don't know. I just thought it was just striking the way that it fell together like that. And that being brought up Catholic, it jumped right out at me.
Craig.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to this. I wasn't at the hearing, and this is not an area that I'm really close to.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dave, thanks very much for the call. We go to Brian next from Madison. Hi, Brian.
Hi. My general comment was just over the last couple of weeks, having NPR on almost constantly as a house dad, noticing the difference in coverage between Virginia Tech and the almost daily killings in Iraq. Over the weekend, I counted up the number of casualties that they were talking about in Iraq, and, you know, it's well over, you know, 100 people a day. But, you know, we have, you know, 32 people who were, of course, tragically killed in Virginia. But just the level of sympathy that we have for our fellow Americans that we don't have for just the citizens of, you know, other human beings that don't happen to be Americans. I mean, you know, a Virginia Tech happens over in Iraq every 8 hours, according to, you know, what I was listening to over the weekend. And it's just given kind of a miss by all of us, and I just thought I'd bring that to people's attention.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. It has been a really hard month for American troops. And I heard this morning 100 deaths, the largest number since this war began. I mean, I do think it is having an impact, Craig, and it's making people very disillusioned. We don't see victory here. We don't see a surge that's doing anything. We're seeing more and more deaths. Maybe we've become somewhat numb to it, but it's also made us believe that we need another course here.
Well, I think if you just look at the polling on this, I mean, the trend line continues to be down, and there's no evidence that there's not much evidence that that's turning around. I mean, I don't think the American public is seeing a compelling case yet that things are improving in Iraq. I think that attitudes toward the war continue to darken. And I think that, and that's the backdrop, certainly, for this collision or potential collision between the legislative and executive branches, between the Democratic majority in Congress and the White House over war funding. I mean, obviously, it's more complicated than that when you delve into public opinion about exactly what people think should be done as a matter of policy. But there, when you talk about their level of hopefulness about a good outcome, and their level of approval for the policy, there's not much evidence that's getting any better or is going to get any better anytime soon for the mm-hmm. administration.
Let's spend a little bit more time on that collision. The president will veto this spending bill that has non-binding request for troops to be withdrawn. What happens after that collision?
Well, I think, the signals that the Democratic leadership has been sending, and there's clearly some debate within the party about this, is that they will try to put together something, they will try to put together a piece of legislation that funds the war and that Bush will sign, ultimately. In other words, they haven't really signaled that they're going to go to the mat. And that we're going to have a real, game of chicken on this with the White House. I don't think that the Democratic leadership is quite prepared to go that route, even though some Democrats are. Russ Feingold was on ABC this week, yesterday, making the case, which he's been making all along, which is that the party shouldn't back down. The party should pursue this course and shouldn't give the president, quote, what he wants. But I'm not sure that's going to be what the Democrats end up doing.
What do you think they're going to do?
Well, again, I think there's going to be some sort of accommodation made. It's one of these cases where nothing can happen without both sides in the dispute being on board. The president can't get his money without the approval of Congress, and there can't be a policy without the approval of the president. So that's why we're at an impasse.
Mm-hmm.
But two things can happen. I mean, the impasse can continue and build sort of a crisis point, or there can be some sort of short-term deal struck. And I think the expectation is more the latter than the former.
Mm-hmm. But what kind of deal do you make here?
Well, that's the problem. It's not like a real sort of midpoint compromise available. I mean, either the White House gets war funding without the deadlines for pullouts, or they don't. And they can agree to some languages on benchmarks that some people might perceive as concessions. But I think Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was on TV yesterday saying that if there were any teeth or consequences attached to the benchmarks, that would be unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That would be unacceptable to the administration.
So what do? You give a surge until a year from now to see if it's working? Or?
Well, as far as the appropriations process goes, you could approve, the money in the bill, and that money will last a certain length of time, and then meanwhile you can come back outside of the appropriations process and try to pass more legislation to force the beginning of troop withdrawal. You can do that by passing a bill that says the troops have to be out by such and such a date. I mean, it gets more complicated
right.
when you do it outside the appropriations process, because then you get into these separation of powers issues,
right.
which is another big collision between the two branches.
Yeah. More phone calls for Craig in a moment. Craig Gilbert is our guest. This part of All Things Political Monday Morning Show, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a couple lines open if you want to talk about the war, if you want to talk about the presidential race. We have yet to talk to him about George Tenet, who's all over the place this weekend and today. We certainly welcome your phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be looking at the wage gap between men and women. Our guest, the president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. They released the results of their study, and the American Association of University Women also released a study about new college graduates last week. So we'll be looking at both of those the second hour. Craig Gilbert is with us now. We go back to phone calls and to Daryl from Delavan. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning. The story that has my attention was it came out, I believe, just 2 weeks ago. So I guess because of the shootings, the school shootings at Virginia Tech, it maybe was overlooked. But a spokesman for the Army stated the fact that the Army regulation concerning our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and their loss of a $1,000 bonus for each month of additional extended tour has been taken away. And now they only receive one additional day of leave for each additional month of their tour is extended. It's obscene and prejudiced to our troops. I did call both Senator Cole and Senator Feingold and my representative this week, or rather last week, to look into this. And I suggest any listeners also call just to be patriotic. I'm afraid that the money they're not getting is going to Halliburton, Bechtel, or Blackwater.
You hear reports, Craig, and maybe because of news like that, which certainly was overlooked, that the troops are having some difficulties with this war. Maybe they're not being treated as fairly as they need to be and should be, and given the respect due them for a very, very difficult task.
Well, it's, you know, the stresses on the military are just immense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly no expert on this. I just know what I hear from people who follow this. And it's you can imagine. I mean, we're relying on a you know, not a huge military to do to do this extended duty under the most terrible circumstances. And I was at an event, I guess it was about a week and a half ago, at a think tank in Washington. It was actually about Cuba, U.S.-Cuba policy. But one of the people who was there was Colin Powell's former chief of staff at the State Department, Lawrence Wilkerson, a military veteran, Colonel Wilkerson, who got a lot of attention not too long ago for really breaking publicly in a very, very critical way with those people in the Bush administration who advocated the Iraq policy and the invasion of Iraq. And somebody asked him at this event about the state of the military. And he was really blunt and just basically said that the military, that the war was wrecking the U.S. military. Now, I don't, you know, there are probably people that would debate that, but it was interesting that he used such strong language in describing the toll that it's taking on readiness, on the troops. I mean, I guess none of this is too surprising in a way, but it's just clearly this was not a mission that we were necessarily set up to do at the outset in terms of the length of the conflict and the nature of the conflict.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Daryl. Scott is next from Madison. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning to you both. I would like to ask if you know much about, I heard over the weekend, I think, that Republican Senator Olympia Snowe, I think she's from Maine, has a proposal out there for funding the troops that would, in fact, have benchmarks embedded within it. And I'm no Democratic strategist, but I can tell you, if I were Harry Reid and the gang after Bush vetoes this current proposal, that's the one I'd glom onto, because wouldn't that put him in a heck of a bind?
Well, I think you may see something like that. I mean, the benchmark seems to be the area where they're headed as a potential middle ground. But again, the big issue there may be whether these benchmarks actually are binding in a sense that if Iraq doesn't meet certain deadlines for making political progress, the U.S., you know, begins to withhold funds for reconstruction and other purposes, or begins to withdraw more troops. But it is interesting in terms of the politics between the two parties. Olympia Snowe has, you know, made it clear that she's willing to work with Democrats on some, quote, middle ground proposals, and I'm sure that Democrats would love to come up with something. But I think they first felt like they had to go through with, you know, and send this bill to President Bush and make it clear that this was where they stood. And now when they come back in the, you know, later phases of this standoff, you may see something like that happen. There was an interesting story somewhere this morning about how the Republicans have really kind of held together, at least when it comes to withdrawal dates, and are under a lot of pressure from Republican voters, not to support a withdrawal date, even though I'm sure there are a fair number of Republicans who are unhappy with the war. But it talked about how some of the House members who supported some of these proposals, like the resolution opposing the surge, have gotten a lot of flack from conservative and Republican voters and constituents in their states. And you only saw, I believe, two House Republicans support the final version of the war supplemental when it went through the House.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, factor in this factor, and that's us. Factor in the American public and all of this, and also that we're in an election time. We have some pretty strong feelings about all of this, and it seems to me as though we ought to be sitting at the table somehow, some way, for a compromise to be reached. How do we factor in, Craig?
Well, you know, you factor in certainly, I mean, Congress as an institution is in theory and in practice responsive to public pressure. The president is, I think it's fair to say, is somewhat less responsive in the sense that he's following a course that he thinks is the right course.
Yes.
He's not up for re-election. He also believes it's his call and that he's, quote, the decider, and that his role in this setting this policy is much more central than the role of Congress. And so so it's unclear how much effect ultimately public pressure will have to bear on what the president decides is the course he wants to follow. So, you know, those are the cross currents at work here. And it's interesting that you've got it's interesting to be watching as this unfolds in a broader sense. You've got a president, a second-term president, who by any measure, you know, whether you like his policies or don't like his policies, in polling terms is one of the least pop. He's going through one of the great, you know, low points in modern mm-hmm. presidencies, yet is sort of sticking by his guns on the central issue of the time, and we haven't kind of seen the kind of sort of wholesale mid-course correction and different approach to working with Congress, with this Democratic Congress, that some people, you know, might have thought you'd see.
Right, yeah. Thanks, Scott, for the call. Let's go to Roger from Dodgeville. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I'm kind of a simple country guy, but one of my questions is, President Bush, you know, keeps standing up and saying, I'm going to veto this. You're putting the troops in harm's way. How can you do this? Blah, blah, blah. Why doesn't somebody say, this is a 50-50, two people have to agree on it, so are you?
Well, that's part of the argument. And that's the push, you know, that's the argument the Democrats are certainly making, is that, you know, the Democrats would say, you know, here's the money, take it. It's there if you'd sign the bill. And President Bush is saying that it's not those conditions are unacceptable to him. So that is the standoff, and that's the argument. I mean, when this happens, you get another battle in addition to the legislative battle. You get a battle over public opinion and over who should be blamed for the standoff, just like we had under President Clinton when there was that famous government shutdown, when there was a Republican Congress and a Democratic president.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a little bit of mystery and suspense in these things in terms of who ultimately has to cave because they're the ones that the public blames for the situation. And we may get to that point in this standoff.
One more call and one more minute. Kathy from East Troy. Hi.
Hi. I really want to know why we keep saying that Congress is not giving the president what he wants. They've given him all of the money he wants, and this is an appropriation bill that's added on because nobody had the guts enough to stand up and add it up in the first place. They just keep nickel and diming us here with an add-on appropriation bill instead of, you know, coming forward and saying, this is what this war costs.
Great.
Well, this is, I mean, again, that's the argument, and the president's getting the money he wants, but he's getting it under conditions that he says are unacceptable. And you're right. I mean, it is costing a lot of money. It's going to continue to cost a lot of money. And once this appropriations, once this money is appropriated, there's going to be probably more battles like this down the road when they have to find more money.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Craig. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Happy Monday.
You too.
Yeah, thanks. Craig Gilbert, our guest this half hour. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We do this Monday at 9 o'clock, all things political, look at what's going on in Washington, what the big stories we're looking at this weekend, over the weekend, and last week as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rita Thomas for producing this hour, and to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, as always, everybody. Copies of this hour, call the radio store. The phone number is 800-747-7444, and the program number of this hour is 430D, 430D. News ahead from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Monday conversations, so please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10 o'clock, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.